Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. After 2 weeks of negotiations and protests by environmental activists and indigenous rights groups, this year's climate talks in Belém, Brazil, ended on Saturday with a resolution that failed to even mention fossil fuels, the main driver of climate change. 10 years ago, at the landmark climate talks in Paris, nearly 200 nations agreed to keep the average increase in global temperatures to well below 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, compared with pre-industrial levels. According to a recent UN report, the Earth is expected to warm by roughly 2.8 degrees Celsius this century compared with pre-industrial levels. Emissions have increased significantly since the Paris Agreement in 2015. Carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels is on track to hit a record high again this year. In 2017, the Carbon Majors Report found that more than half of global industrial emissions since 1988 can be traced to just 25 corporations and state-owned entities. The highest emitters are ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron. Kaveh Glengore with the nonprofit Center for Climate and Energy Solutions told NPR that while the UK and many European and Latin American countries supported a roadmap away from fossil fuels at COP30, countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia were not on board. The United States under Trump, with his drill baby drill policies, did not attend. Kaveh Glengore says countries were split about 50-50. Here's a clip from the PBS NewsHour featuring two indigenous activists. The first activist, Alessandro Corap Manduruka, talks about what's happening in the Amazon. In 2023, she was awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize. She led many protests at COP, including one with indigenous activists who forced their way into the venue to demand a seat at the table. The second activist is a leader with the Tupinambá community in the Amazon.
When the river gets dry, the ones who suffer are us.
They also demanded a meeting with Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
We will stay until the president solves our problem. They deforested everything, and now we're under the scorching sun. While he negotiates with the AC inside the house, we stay here suffering under the scorching sun.
Friday's demonstration was peaceful, but it followed an incident on Tuesday where indigenous protesters forced their way into the COP30 venue, clashing with security personnel.
We don't eat money. We want our territory free. But the business of oil exploration, mineral exploration, and logging continues.
Thanks to the PBS NewsHour for that clip. The talks ended with an announcement from Colombia's Environment Minister, Elena Velez Torres, about a new conference next April. In this clip, you will hear from Elena Velez Torres and NPR's Julia Simon.
Yesterday, Irene Velez Torres, Colombia's environment minister, along with ministers from Europe, Latin America, the Pacific Islands, Torres announced that they are making a new conference next year in Santa Marta, Colombia. This conference is explicitly dedicated to discussions around phasing out fossil fuels. Here is Minister Torres.
The idea of the Santa Marta conference is to have this first space in which we are completely clear that the phasing out is necessary, because it's not easy. No one is saying that it is easy. But if we don't face the problems, we cannot build the solutions.
Joining us to discuss COP30 and what's next are two guests. Ilan Zugman is Managing Director for Latin America at 350.org and a climate action activist based in Brazil. He says indigenous peoples and frontline communities made their message clear. Real climate action means ending fossil fuels and delivering the financing that communities need to survive. The lack of concrete commitments in the final text shows us who is still benefiting from the delay? The fossil fuel industry and the ultra-rich, not those living the climate crisis every day. Hi, Ilan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you. We're also joined by Mark Hertzgaard, the nation's environment correspondent and executive director of the Global Media Collaboration covering Climate Now. And Mark also joins us from Belém, Brazil. Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. So you were both at the climate summit, and I want to read the take from Jonathan Watts, the Guardian's global environment correspondent, who wrote, "The outcome was not nearly enough to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. There was a considerable shortfall in the finance needed for adaptation by the countries worst affected. The importance of rainforest protection barely got a mention, even though this was the first climate summit in the Amazon, and the power balance in the world is still so skewed towards gas, oil, and coal interests that there wasn't even a single mention of fossil fuels in the main agreement." So, Elon, what are your thoughts about this main agreement? Can you give us a sense of how we got to this place at the conference?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think the assessments that you were describing now resonate a lot with me. We had a very weak agreement and very far from what we need to keep temperatures around 1.5 degrees, or now it's looking clear that will be unlikely that we'll be able to maintain it. So we had some great momentum at the beginning of the second week of the negotiations of the COP, where almost 90 countries were backing the roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels. But unfortunately, due to pressure from oil states like Saudi Arabia, and also due to the fact that some of the richest countries were not wanting to put more money in the table to support the transitioning from countries from the global south, this deal escaped. We still got an important mention by the COP presidency that the roadmaps are going to be built outside of the negotiations text, which is something important, but still really far from what we currently need.
Elon, can you also tell us about the role that Indigenous activists played here? We played the clip there from a couple of Indigenous activists, very prominent activists, including Alessandra Karap Munduruka. And she told Democracy Now! That her people traveled about 5 days by bus and boat. And, you know, she said that she had, she was officially there, but so many of her people were not. And every day we saw so many protests by Indigenous activists. And in many cases, and in the one case, they forced their way in and scuffled with security guards to demand a seat at the table. Can you tell us about the role that Indigenous activists played over the last 2 weeks?
Of course, yeah. Well, Alessandra Munduruku is a great leader and a great partner as well. Huge inspiration to all of us. But yes, unfortunately, the Blue Zone, the official space where the COP negotiations happened, it's still a space that not a lot of people can get inside. Although this COP had the highest presence of Indigenous people, including the Blue Zone, still a space that not many can access. So one of the things that we worked this year in partnership with Indigenous people from Brazil was really for them to have the co-presidency of the COP30 sit in the table and have decisions with the presidency. We couldn't get this demand attended. We were able to get a circle of Indigenous leadership, but it was more a consulting role than a decision role, which was not what Indigenous people were hoping. But in my opinion, the presence of Indigenous people and also from other traditional communities like Quilombolas, Riverine, social movements from Brazil, it was so powerful. And in my opinion, one of the best things of this COP, their role there really helped to put more pressure in the world leaders. It was great that we see some Indigenous lands being demarcated during the conference. This was also a result by the pressure that happened in Belém. And the issue of fossil fuels and ending deforestation, those two roadmaps that were mentioned, I believe that if it was not due to the huge amount of mobilizations and people power that we saw in Belém, we would not have even that mention in the ending plenary of the COP30.
And Mark, you've been covering these conferences for so many years. You've got a new piece out in The Nation today, writing in a diplomatic black eye for the host country, Brazil. What had been promoted as a summit of truth and implementation delivered little of either. Give us your assessment of what happened at this COP, Mark.
Sure. You know, I was here in 1992 at the UN Earth Summit that began all of these COP negotiations. And, you know, it took 28 COPs until 2 years ago before the words fossil fuels were even mentioned in these agreements. And that reflects the enormous power of petrostates, including the United States, which blocked that all that time. Now, coming into COP30, I think President Lula here in Brazil genuinely wanted to see progress, and it looked very promising. 2 weeks ago, there was a pre-COP30, there was a leaders summit where heads of state and government came from around the world. It looked very promising at that point, but as has been mentioned here, essentially what happened is the petrostates used the UN process to block any progress. All of these COP negotiations take place under UN rules, which means that there must be consensus behind decisions. Consensus does not necessarily mean unanimous, but if there are a number of states, including especially when these are powerful states like Saudi Arabia, like Russia, like the United States, which wasn't even there, they can block anything. And that's what happened. It's interesting. You mentioned, Rose, the piece by Jonathan Watts in The Guardian. It was Jonathan's reporting that revealed how the rainforest roadmap also got killed here. The Brazilian foreign ministry, in what The Guardian called either a terrible diplomatic blunder or outright sabotage, the foreign ministry inserted the deforestation roadmap into the same passage that had the fossil fuel roadmap. And so when Saudi Arabia and the other petrostates said, no, we're not going to go for any of this fossil fuel phase out business, it ended up killing both provisions at once.
Mark, can you explain to people how the process works at COP? Because this time around, more than 1,600 fossil fuel lobbyists were granted access to COP. And then The Guardian's Nina Lacani and Rachel Sherrington have a piece about the more than 300 big agricultural lobbyists that were at COP. Meat and dairy sent the largest, accounting for 72. This is almost double the number negotiating on behalf of Jamaica, the island nation that was left devastated by Hurricane Melissa last month. And then India, they sent a delegation of 87 negotiators. So how does this all work behind the scenes, Mark? Who makes these decisions to allow these lobbyists into COP and to give them a seat at the table?
I think that's the right question. And with all due respect to my colleagues, I take a bit of a heterodox position on this. Those lobbyists, what really matters is, are they there as part of a delegation, meaning that they are inside the negotiating rooms, or are they there as observer status, which does not necessarily mean you're in the negotiating rooms. It means that you're walking around the blue zone. And it's, you know, these COPs, they are massive. There's 56,000 people at this one. They're kind of like conventions or trade shows. And so everybody's showing off, this is what product that we're doing. And so I'm not saying it's not a problem. It is a problem, especially in the case of countries like Saudi Arabia, where, you know, Saudi Aramco, they are the biggest oil producing company in the world. They happen to be a state-owned company. So when those two lines are crossed, when there are delegates that are actually in the negotiating rooms, that is when you have a problem. And meanwhile, only 14% of the indigenous people who requested access, even just as observers, only 14% of them were granted access, even as hundreds of industry lobbyists were given observer status.
You know, Elon, a lot of people are wondering, what is the point of these conferences anymore, given that the lobbyists have so much power, petrostates have so much power, and this time around, when we're dealing with so many crises around the globe, fossil fuels weren't even mentioned in the resolution. So what is the point of these conferences anymore, do you think?
Yeah, I think these are some important questions. But in my opinion, the COPs are still The best space that we have is the official one, where all of the countries in the world come together to discuss how we can tackle the climate crisis. It's not delivering exactly what we need with the urgency that's needed, but we have been able to have some sometimes small advances, sometimes medium in the multilateralism. I think it's really hard for us to achieve like big wins, so it's more about advancements. And as Mark was saying, we had like the COP28, the first time mentioning fossil fuels, so that was an important point. At COP29, unfortunately, things did not advance a lot. And at this COP, although we did not see the final text mentioning fossil fuels, I saw a great momentum of this initiative for the roadmap transition away from fossil fuels. This is something that happened for the first time in a COP. We had many press conferences of literally dozens of countries getting together and saying that they want this roadmap. And of course, now we're going to have an independent process with the first ever conference for phasing out fossil fuels happening in Colombia in April. So we need to keep that momentum. But of course, it's important for us to try different things, as what Colombia is doing now, co-hosting this conference with the Netherlands. But still, we still need the COPs. And of course, it's important for us to try not other processes, or maybe also discuss if some reforms are needed. The consensus that Mark was mentioning, of course, it's a point that it's super hard to get sometimes, especially when powerful countries are blocking things. So maybe some reforms, but still it's working, not as much as we hope for, but we see from time to time some achievements.
I agree that it's going to be the conference in April is really where the focus will be now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the heroes in this conference, Colombia is at the top of that list, along with the Netherlands. But Colombia was very forceful. And these kinds of meetings don't have to be a petrostate victory. And go back just 2 years ago to COP28, where fossil fuels, a phase out of fossil fuels was finally put on the table. That happened. Why did Saudi Arabia not block it then? Because the United States was there with a pro-climate action administration in Joe Biden. You can say what you like about Joe Biden not being a perfect climate leader, but at COP28, the U.S. was able to lean on Saudi Arabia and say, no, you are not going to block that reference. So a lot depends on what America brings to the table. You know, I don't think that the Saudis would have felt anywhere near as emboldened at this last conference to be such a blocking force if Donald Trump weren't basically showing utter contempt for climate action.
I'm sure a lot of people didn't even know about that, Mark, that the U.S. put pressure on Saudi Arabia last time.
Well, the U.S. puts pressure on anybody that it likes, and the difference is decisive. So it's a reminder for Americans, you know, think about who you're voting into power, because it's not just about the price of eggs in your local supermarket. It's about what kind of actions come out of these international summits. And what's happened here, there was an important victory here, by the way, a partial victory, which was that the agreement includes a tripling of the amount of money that rich countries have to send to poor countries to adapt to the increasingly deadly extreme weather and storms and sea level rise that are now inevitable. That money has been tripled, and that would not happen outside of these processes. But a lot more is needed. And in the meantime, that I say it's a partial victory because that money is not required to come until 2035. That's 10 years from now. We're in Brazil right now. You can see that people are suffering in this country and countries around the world who are frontline communities. Oxfam Brazil said of this final agreement that it leaves the millions of people on the front lines of this crisis suffering with very few options of how to survive.
Mark Hertzgaard is the nation's environment correspondent and executive director of Covering Climate Now, a global media collaboration. that focuses on all things climate. Ilan Zugman is Managing Director for Latin America at 350.org and a climate action activist based in Brazil. Today, we are talking about what happened at COP30. It wrapped up over the weekend. The final resolution failed to even mention fossil fuels, the main driver of climate change. Ilan, it was also interesting to learn in an interview with NPR, Kaveh Gallingore with the nonprofit Center for Climate and Energy Solutions said while the UK and many EU and Latin American countries supported a roadmap away from fossil fuels, countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia were not on board. He said that countries were split 50-50. So do you know, can you tell us, how does that work? If something is split about 50-50, what resolution or what words end up in the resolution? Who makes the final decision?
Yeah, well, it's a complicated process. And then it's when the COP presidency needs to really do the consultations and where the negotiation aspects really take place. So we had really a big number of countries supporting the roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels, and a lot also of countries blocking it. But what we heard, it was that during the second week of the negotiations, the Brazil presidency could have done a better job. We heard lots of observers complaining that the process was mostly done behind closed doors. We also heard from negotiations that they did not have a lot of time together to discuss the text. It was mostly done in bilateral, so that's not help as well when such important topics are being discussed. So the process of the presidents could have been better during the second week. But of course, even with a very good process, when we have powerful countries blocking an agreement, it's something really hard to get it. As Mark was saying, without some powerful countries putting pressure on others to accept things, makes things harder. And then the other element that I think it's important to mention, that although the European Union was very favorable of this roadmap, they were blocking more money to the climate finance target, to go to global south countries, and that was something that was not helpful at all. So there's some really tough negotiations that happened, but I think that if the European Union was able to put more money in the climate finance targets, this could also have helped other countries from the global south to be favorable to mention fossil fuels in the final text.
And, Mark, yeah, and ultimately, the powerful countries have a veto because of the consensus nature of UN decision making. Big countries have a veto, but only big countries. So I was there in Glasgow at COP26 when at the very, very, very last minute, when the agreement was about to call for the phase out of coal, which is the dirtiest, most carbon intensive fossil fuel. At the very last minute, India and China objected. And that threw everything into a tizzy. And there was a suspension of the session. And when we came back, there was no longer a phase out of coal. There was a talk of a phase down of coal. So, and meanwhile, island state and low-lying country and vulnerable country, one after another, with tears in their eyes, spoke up after this happened and said, "You are killing us with this decision. We can't block it because we're not powerful enough, but we want you to know what you're doing." So it's veto power for the big boys and suck it up and take it for the little ones. That's how it works when it's a consensus-based decision in the UN. And by the way, we haven't talked about this very much. China could have played a much more positive role here than it did. China was very quiet. It saw that the U.S. was not here. It was going to let the U.S. take all the blame for this. And look, China is doing a lot of great things with solar power. It's building it out faster than any other country in the world, but it is also still increasing its burning of coal. So China, I'm sure, was also not in favor of a roadmap for transitioning away from fossil fuels, but it just stayed quiet and isn't getting any of the flack that the Saudis and the Russians are getting now.
Why do you think that is, Mark?
You know, I haven't done the reporting, so I hesitate to speculate. And I've spent enough time in China to know that the Chinese at the leadership level, they do take climate change very seriously. They know that it poses an absolutely mortal threat to China, in particular, its ability to feed itself because of basically the droughts that are going to be hitting northern China, already are hitting it increasingly. But as in so many other countries and so many other economies that are still relying on fossil fuels, the number one thing that President Xi of China wants to retain his grip on power, he's got to keep delivering economic growth, or so he thinks. And in order to do that, he wants to continue burning a lot of coal, even as he builds out solar and wind and alternatives and electric vehicles. So he is, you know, playing both sides against the middle, basically. And, you know, they're shrewd diplomats, and you got to hand it to them on that front, that China played this extremely well for China's perceived national interests. But the results are extremely bad for the millions of people around the world on the front lines. And by the way, all of the young people and children in China itself. We are now locked into at least 1.7 degrees of temperature rise, likely a lot more. But even at 1.7, we are going to be pushing up, according to the science, against these very, very dangerous so-called tipping points, where you can have catastrophic, irreversible changes, like the Amazon rainforest becoming a savanna, like the polar ice caps melting, which once that starts, you cannot stop it. And then you're talking about 20 feet of sea level rise around the planet. That would put literally billions of people's homes underwater. So we've got to prevent that stuff. And what we saw at COP30 here in Belém was the short-term thinking and greed, frankly, of petrostates deciding that they're going to play to their own perceived self-interest.
Oh, Elon, hearing Mark talk about the Amazon made me think about an article that I just haven't been able to read yet because it is so devastating. I'll just read the headline. In The Guardian, it came out earlier this month. Amazon lakes hit unbearable hot tub temperatures amid mass die-offs of pink river dolphins. Droughts and heat waves are causing water in some areas to reach 41 degrees Celsius, killing fish and endangered dolphins. And it's just so hard to read this, to think that these dolphins are dying because the water is too hot. I mean, this is just devastating.
Yeah, that's the reality of climate change, and things might get worse without us cutting fossil fuels urgently and doing a just energy transition as fast as possible. We work with a lot of partners and communities in the Amazon, and these reports are coming out every year, and things are getting more intense. Some parts of the Amazon, as Mark was saying, might reach a tipping point or already reaching that tipping point and becoming drier and drier. Other parts of the Amazon are now starting to emit more greenhouse gas emissions than they sequestrate. So the Amazon is really losing this balance. Some of the ecosystem service that the rainforest provides to the world, like the rain to many parts of the America and the food systems. So we're starting to lose all of these benefits. Science tells us that's still possible to reverse it. We still have a chance, but that window of opportunity, it's closing. If we don't take direct action by the end of this decade, we need to sharply reduce emissions all over the world.
And
there's
we
the
should
happy
say,
news here too.
Just really quickly, just, Mark, just quickly, yeah. Because I really just want to give these dolphins the attention that they deserve. 40 degrees Celsius is 104 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the water that these dolphins are swimming in. One of the researchers said that when you put your finger in, you have to take it out because it's just so hot. And I just also want to mention, Mark, because you wrote about the Amazon, I just wish this got more attention. According to The Guardian, agriculture is responsible for a quarter to a third of global emissions. cattle ranching is the biggest driver of deforestation in the Amazon, followed by the industrial production of soy, which is mostly used to feed these animals. And the indigenous activists were talking about soy. And people who eat meat, they don't know where it comes from in many cases. They don't even know what company produces it. So it's just really important to point that out, because in many parts of the world, demand for meat is going up.
Yes, and Brazil has the largest meat company in the world, JPB, that is deeply implicated in all this. And yes, I was in the Amazon River a couple of weeks ago here. And if you care about the dolphins, if you care about all of this, folks who are listening, let's remember, on the positive side, there's 80 to 89% of the world's people want their governments to take stronger action on climate change. That is an overwhelming majority. You know, when we in the press report on elections, if some candidate wins by 60%, we call it a landslide. This is a super landslide of people all around the world who want their governments to do more. But the kicker is that this supermajority does not realize it's a majority. It thinks it's a minority. So it doesn't act like a majority. It doesn't vote like a majority. It doesn't talk to their friends and neighbors like they're a majority. And when that happens, when we treat democracy as a spectator sport, rather than getting in there and making sure to vote and help other people vote and to push the candidates and to lobby and protest and so forth, all the different things, you get results like this. But it does not have to happen this way. And Covering Climate Now has a project called the 89% Project, which is spreading this fact that there is a massive global majority that wants action, but that is not mobilized yet. And that's up to you folks who are listening and to the rest of civil society, is to realize there is a majority here. It needs to be mobilized and brought to bear on these governments who are blocking action.
Do you both believe that the April conference in Colombia, it'll be the first conference to focus on a just transition away from fossil fuels? Do you think that that will be significant? And do you think that that could create more momentum, Elon?
Well, we need to wait a bit more to see how many countries are going to really participate on it. But what we saw during COP was great. We saw already dozens of countries backing it. Of course, we need to see some of the big oil producers as well joining this conference to discuss. It's good that we saw, for example, Norway there, Australia, and others like Brazil, hopefully is also going to join. The COP presidency in the final plenary was mentioning this conference as the next big moment to discuss an end to the fossil fuel era. So yeah, I think momentum is growing, and this conference have a lot of things to discuss. We are being involved in the social participation, and also are going to be together to see what role indigenous leaders are going to have in this conference outside, of course, the official government spaces. So yeah, I believe we can see some good things coming out of this conference. And we need to, of course, build momentum then towards COP31 in Turkey, where probably the COP presidency will present some of the results of this roadmap, the advance that we're able to be made. But yeah, we need to wait a bit more, but momentum is growing for sure.
And your thoughts on that, Mark?
I agree. I think that's where the action is now. I plan to be there in April in Colombia to see what happens. But, you know, again, remember, most of the countries at COP30 wanted that roadmap. It's a relatively small, albeit very powerful and rich minority of countries that blocked it. So if you can get the rest of the world outside of the COP process, and bear in mind, at Colombia, there will not be that consensus decision making that allows a couple of foot draggers to block things. It's going to be a separate conference. And I think that we're very likely to see California Governor Gavin Newsom there. I interviewed Governor Newsom when he was here at COP30, and he was making the point to the world's media and to other governments that don't judge our country by what goes on in the United States. Donald Trump does not represent American opinion on climate change. California is the fourth largest economy in the world. We grew from being the sixth largest to the fourth largest economy while tripling down on our commitment to green energy, such that California now gets two-thirds of its electricity from clean energy sources. So if you get Gavin Newsom, and let's hope also a lot of other governors and mayors and other perhaps green businesses from the United States and other countries coming to Columbia and saying, look, we're in. Trump is not going to be president forever. And we are going to be pushing this and, you know, moving the process forward. I think that it's very possible that we can see action. And again, this is where, you know, if you're listening and you want to do something about this, urge your elected representatives to pay attention to this, to be speaking out on it, and maybe go to Columbia and be part of that roadmap to fossil fuel phase out.
Mark Hertzgard is the nation's environment correspondent and executive director of Covering Climate Now, a global media collaboration focusing on these issues. Ilan Zugman is managing director for Latin America at 350.org and a climate action activist based in Brazil. Thank you both for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank Obrigado. You.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we'll talk about a new Inside Climate News report called Global Rush for Copper is Hitting the Amazon. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about how copper mining projects are threatening indigenous communities at the edge of the Amazon Basin in Colombia. Copper forms the core of electric motors and turbine generators. It makes electrical cables, wires, and circuit board pathways. A large data center for artificial intelligence uses tens of thousands of tons of copper. According to a report by Wood Mackenzie, demand for copper is expected to surge by 24% over the next decade, and that will require building dozens of new mines at a breakneck pace. Joining us is Dylan Bidor, a reporter with the Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit news organization Inside Climate News. He covers the energy sector and environmental justice in Texas, and his new piece is called The Global Rush for Copper is Hitting the Amazon. Hi, Dylan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So we were just talking about COP30 and the powerful protests led by indigenous activists who are fighting to protect their communities from exploitation, whether it's oil and gas companies, their own governments, or now the accelerating demand for minerals and metals in the clean energy sector. And as you write about copper, this is hitting the Amazon and this is hitting indigenous communities very hard. Why do you think that this doesn't get more attention?
Well, for one, it doesn't get much attention yet because it's only emerging, I think, broadly in the public view, and because the explosive copper demand, you know, according to projections, still lays ahead of us. The mines that we're talking about here, the vast majority are in development. Around the edge of the Amazon or in early exploration. One in Ecuador began operating, you know, a few years ago, and it did clear, you know, hundreds or thousands of acres of Amazonian rainforest and has been been the basis for a fight with local indigenous communities. And it's gotten attention, but as these projects really start to sink in all over, including in Brazil, Colombia, Peru, I believe it will get more attention.
And can you tell us more about copper? I mentioned what it's used for in the introduction. You quoted Thayana Alvarez, a Colombia vice president of Copper Giant. And Thayana said copper, they say, is the next petroleum.
Yes, indeed. The new oil, because copper is at the heart of electrical technology in general, because it is such a good conductive metal. It's really the most desired substance to put in wires or power cables. You know, an electric generator, you spin magnets around copper coils. Maybe you've seen in the alternator of your car. And an electric car works the kind of opposite way. You electrify copper coils that spin magnets. a data center, because it requires so much power, those are all copper cables, copper wires going to every single unit, delivering, you know, up to a gigawatt of power, which now we're talking about 27,000 tons of copper for one of these facilities.
Wow.
Yeah. And copper, you know, lots of engineers, material scientists stress, we don't need copper per se, which is why I never wrote in the piece that any of these technologies need copper. It's just sort of the preferential metal, the cheapest, the best balance of different, different, you know, characteristics. So I'll finish saying that you mentioned, I think, a Wood Mackenzie report that gave four reasons for copper demand. We've talked about two, which is the renewable energy and data centers. Another one, which are perhaps a bit more surprising, the spread of electrification in China and India. So the rapid, you know, emergence of things like household wiring, and the rearmament of Europe. All the defense spending is actually creating a big global drive for copper demand. So that's why we expect to see all these mines coming up in the next couple of years.
It's interesting that you say copper is not even needed, because whenever we do shows about lithium, cobalt, nickel, any of these elements that are needed for green energy projects, this is the question people ask is, do you have to use this? So what else could be used besides copper?
Yeah, well, you have to use something, is what it comes down to. And so aluminum is a common copper alternative, you know, like power lines that you see hanging. Those are made of aluminum because that would be way too expensive with copper. It's just not as good. Other conductive metals, but aluminum also has to be mined and has to be smelted. You know, I learned that here at Rice University in Texas, there's a research group that has created these carbon nanotubes. It's a carbon material that they say is as hard and malleable and conductive as steel. So, you know, technological innovations, which is sort of what we most typically rely on. But, you know, aside from carbon nanotubes, almost everything is going to have to be extracted somehow. So it really comes down to be a question of how wisely do we, you know, use or kind of allocate those resources, that copper that we have, to make perhaps only what's necessary.
And you went to Mocoa, Colombia, to report on this piece. And this is where copper mining is happening. This is where the Andes Mountains meet the Amazon rainforest. Can you tell us more about this area?
Yeah, it's a beautiful and a kind of mystifying area. It is right at the foothills of the Andes. So the jungle creeps up, you know, a few hundred yards or meters up there. And as you go up, you kind of get out of that sweltering heat and humidity, and it begins to get cooler and mistier. Things are always wet, covered in moss and orchids and bromeliads and all kinds of birds and mountains. And, you know, there's not actually copper mining occurring yet. Technically, it's an exploration project. So a Canadian company is drilling holes to explore, document copper resources that they're coming, reporting are bigger and bigger. And they have a lot of acreage up there. So they're looking at the prospect of a large copper mine coming in the future in an area that's now really a lot of wilderness and indigenous reservations, where communities live in a, you know, still rural and agrarian sort of lifestyle. So it'll be a big change for them. And Mocoa itself is surrounded also by indigenous reservations. There's probably about a dozen different ethnicities that are represented there, and they have their association kind of right in the heart of the city. So it's a sort of enclave of culture there, and it hasn't been too much disturbed yet. So that's what worries people.
Your piece opens with Zuli Rivera, a water defender and youth coordinator for the NASA Pueblo. There's a really nice photo of her standing near the river. And she said, "They come to rob us. For more than 500 years, they have robbed us. And today they continue." You know, she says, first it was oil, and now it's copper. And she's the daughter of social leaders and an administrator for her community's territorial defense unit. She's part of an activist network called Guardians of the Andino Amazonia that want to prevent the development of mining in the mountains of Makoa. Can you tell us more about her and the work that her community is doing?
Yeah, so she is part of, as you said, the Nasa Pueblo, which is one of several groups there. And, you know, she is a kind of one of many, many leaders in this movement who are trying to reach out to people and explain to them what this all will mean for their environment, for their community, basically doing a publicity campaign against copper mining, because as you imagine, the copper companies themselves have a lot of resources to do a lot of public outreach. They do a lot of, you know, education, they say, and awareness. They hold events where people can go get coffee. They sponsor sports games. They sponsor community groups and politicians. So it results in a large, you know, flood of material that says this whole copper thing is going to be really great for everybody. And Suli is part of a group of people who are going to help counter that with especially young people and explain the importance of these wild mountains and the sources of their water that run through them, the way that their cultures are dependent on aspects of this environment, including the animals and the just intact landscape as it is, and reminding them of the importance of all the things that their cultures and ancestors have gathered from this environment. You know, they say that they talk to Mother Earth, they talk to the spirits here. And, you know, as these things get lost, they will never come back. And despite, you know, copper is so associated with clean energy, green energy revolution. But what these people fear is that now you just turn our town into a big business center. There's going to be lots of money. They've seen this story many times before. The indigenous cultures get pushed to the edge and eventually kind of bankrupt and drawn in. And once they're gone, there's no coming back.
Hmm. And Zuli Rivera is 34 years old. And as you just pointed out, she said it's not really the copper that she cares about. It's the spirit of the place. She worries that new roads through the jungle, new money in politics, and an influx of new residents will transform this area into a busy mining town. She says people from outside do not know the value this has. For them, it is just a mountain. Can I just ask you, and we'd love to have you back to talk more about your piece, but given that things are moving so fast in the U.S. and around the world to transition to green energy, to embrace electric cars and solar and wind and all of these things, what is it like for you to interview someone like Zuli Rivera, who is so affected by what we're doing here in this country? And sometimes people don't make the connections.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a reminder that to see it from her perspective, there's really nothing new to this story. We're doing exactly the same thing we've been doing for centuries, just moving on from one focus to another. The reason all the mines are in indigenous territory around the world is because all the previous mines were also in indigenous territory, but we took them, mined them, done. People live there and the indigenous people are gone. So, you know, it just continues along that way. The real solutions, it essentially drives home that we're not going to be able to sustain a path of unlimited consumption and entitlement to unlimited energy for whatever, you know, the market calls for, just as long as we find some cleaner ways of generating it. The problem is the degree of growth of our energy demand itself and of our consumption. And remember, how much of this copper is going to go to junky consumer projects? I mean, products that sit in your closet, you know, your three coffee makers, your old vacuum cleaners. I mean, much of it just ends up in a landfill. And until we can get those systems really, I think, under wraps, yeah, I mean, just give it a few years, you know. People knew so much about oil drilling in the Amazon. Now we're going to move to new extractive industries, and you'll hear plenty about mining for copper and cobalt and lithium and things like that.
Dylan, I think you make such a good point, and I'd love to have you back to do a show about this. We are hardly talking about consumption anymore. Instead, or public transportation for that matter, we're talking about what will it take for electric cars to be cheaper? I mean, of course that's important. We want people to have access to these things, but at what cost? You know, Amazon just opened a center in Hawaii, and so you can get things overnight there now. I mean, this is just, it's crazy. I mean, there's so much consumption happening, and we're hardly talking about that anymore. It's just the transition is now the new word. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I would be skeptical that there's too much of a transition underway, and I know that's kind of blasphemy in my field, but based on what I've seen. And let's keep in mind that all these electric cars and most of these electronic products are made essentially on the outside of plastic, which is the main driver of demand growth in fossil fuels for oil. These are petrochemicals. So, you know, we don't really have a material substitute to plastic. So every electronic item we make essentially has that. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the conversation has just sort of abandoned ideas of broader practices of, you know, is it practical to put limits on our energy use and consumption, or to, you know, prioritize distribution? Because keep in mind how much data centers have thrown off the whole equation of this energy transition. I think it looked a lot better until we got artificial intelligence saying we need, however, to grow tremendously power generation and copper demand and all this kind of stuff in the next years. And suddenly it's like, oh, you know, all bets are off. Now we just need as much energy as possible. So if that just happens every step of the way, you know, we're never going to catch up with ourselves.
You have a great quote in your piece from Zuli Rivera, who says, "We are not interested in your flying cars and robots in Europe and Asia if all the minerals come from South America."
Yeah, you know, for her, she's heard all of this before. I mean, every time the companies come in, it was gold, then it was oil, now it's copper. Obviously, they come saying this is going to be great and bring wealth and prosperity to your community and to the world. And so for her, that's not a new pitch. And ultimately, you know, it's like her community doesn't really need electric vehicles.
Well, Dylan, your piece is so important, with really incredible photos by Tom Laffey. So thank you so much for your work. And we'd love to have you back about this wider conversation around consumption and the green transition. Dylan Bidor is a reporter with the Pulitzer Prize winning nonprofit Inside Climate News. Be sure to check out his piece, "Global Rush for Copper is Hitting the Amazon." Thank you so much, Dylan.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.